here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. Aisha Roscoe, good morning. With a suspect in custody for the shooting of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, some public safety experts are asking questions about the event where Kirk was shot.
No one checking bags, no metal detectors. We didn't see really any security.
And the Federal Reserve is expected to lower interest rates at its meeting this week. Find out what that may mean for the economy. And later, we look at a crowdsourced effort in New Zealand to save some unique birds from extinction. Plus, ancient lullabies as modern folk music. It's Sunday, September 14th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Minnesota county leaders are expecting a significant shift in cost to their budget from the state and federal governments because of various legislation. In Beltrami County, proposed cuts to libraries and the local history museum are on the table to offset the burden. Larissa Donovan has the story.
County Administrator Tom Berry says a committee worked to deliver an increase of less than 10% to the proposed property tax levy for 2026. At a recent meeting, he pointed to cost shifts as driving factors, including for probation, health and human services like Medicaid and SNAP, and the state's new Paid Family and Medical Leave Act.
That's why the tax pie is starting to get bigger. And you can expect that to grow if the state continues down the path that it's headed.
The board set a list of budget priorities earlier in the year, which included financing mission-focused operations such as health and human services before giving money to outside organizations. This includes the library system and historical society. At the Bemidji Public Library, branch manager Sherilyn Warren says the proposed reduction will bring the county's contribution down to what's known as the minimum maintenance of effort as part of the state's library system. This year, Beltrami County gave nearly $438,000 to the Bemidji and Black Deck Libraries. The Kitchigami Regional Library System requested just over $450,000 for the two libraries for 2026, but Beltrami County proposes far less, about $265,000.
Even if we committed to cutting all material purchases for 2026, which is not buying any new materials, we would still have to find over $100,000 to cut from our budget for 2026. And feasibly, the only way to do that would be to cut hours of operation and to cut staffing levels.
Beltrami County Historical Society's Executive Director Emily Thabe says Beltrami County's proposed $7,500 cut represents about 8% of the center's annual budget.
Dollars that we miss now, that is history that turns to dust. It is history that rusts and crumbles and is not digitized and is not saved. And it's decades that gets washed away from our memories.
The county is expected to set its preliminary budget and levy for 2026 at its meeting Tuesday. The levy amount can be decreased between then and December when the final decision is made. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
Drivers should expect delays on Highway 2 in Grand Rapids next week. The Minnesota Department of Transportation says milling and paving work begins Monday. Work will take place in the city the first 2 days, including on Southeast 7th Avenue and Northeast 8th Avenue. Tuesday through Friday, crews will work between Northeast 3rd Street and Culp Road east of La Prairie. There may be extended delays, especially during commuting hours. MnDOT says to expect flagging operations, lane closures, and pilot cars. Highway 7 near Iron Junction will close for about 5 days starting Monday. St. Louis County says crews will be working on the CN Railroad crossing between Old Mesabi Road and Ramshaw Road North. The recommended detour is lengthy, routing drivers to Highway 53 via Highway 37 or through Eveleth. The University of Minnesota is accepting nominations from Northwestern Minnesota for its Growing Local Leadership course. The program aims to address the growing governmental and nonprofit leadership shortage in the state. The hybrid course includes online and in-person meetings at Shooting Star Casino in Minomin. The sliding scale fee includes meals and lodging. Nominators are asked to consider young adults, college students, new residents, empty nesters, and people from underrepresented groups as future leaders for their communities. The U uses a broad definition of Northwest Minnesota, stretching from Morris to Park Rapids to Bedette. Applications and nominations close Monday. Find more information at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at kaxe.org, where you can also find content from our music, Phenology, and morning show teams. Sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from your favorite community radio station. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Edition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Prosecutors in Utah yesterday said they intend to file murder charges against the 22-year-old man who they believe assassinated conservative activist Charlie Kirk. The suspect, Tyler Robinson, is being held in a county jail. For more on this ongoing story, we're joined by NPR's Bobby Allen in Salt Lake City. Good morning, Bobby.
Hey, Aisha.
So what's the latest in the case against the suspected shooter, Tyler Robinson?
Well, Utah County prosecutors said they intend to file aggravated murder charges against him on Tuesday when he is also set to make his first court appearance. The charges carry the possible punishment of the death penalty if convicted. And most of what we know about the case so far is outlined in an affidavit that was filed after Robinson's arrest. And it says Robinson discussed with his family that Charlie Kirk was coming to Utah Valley University and that he really disliked Kirk, telling them that Kirk was, quote, full of hate and spreading hate. Authorities have video and photo evidence of what they say is his escape from a campus roof following the single shot that hit Kirk in the neck about 150 yards away and killed him.
Now, this shooting happened at a public amphitheater with thousands in attendance. What security breakdowns may have allowed this to happen?
Yeah, that's a huge question right now. There were only six police officers working the event. Kirk had his own security, but public safety experts have questioned whether a bigger security staff was needed at an event attended by more than 3,000 people. I talked to one of them, Keenan Cantrell. He's a big Kirk fan and says he was about 50 feet away from the stage when Kirk was fatally shot. Cantrell says he thinks the university could have done more to fortify the event site.
How the crap did security mess this up so badly that this was able to happen? No one checking bags, no metal detectors. We didn't see really any security.
Now, Utah Valley University's campus has been closed since the shooting, but it's expected to reopen on Monday.
Back to the suspected shooter, Robinson. What have we learned about him since he was apprehended?
Yeah, Robinson grew up in a small town in southwestern Utah. His family matched the profile of many people in that part of the state. Avid hunters, his parents were registered Republicans. Growing up, Robinson was a gifted student. His mom had posted to Facebook about how he was a 4.0 average in middle school, did well in high school, and received a college scholarship, but he only completed one semester. As for Robinson's own politics, he was registered to vote in Utah, but he had no party affiliation.
Do we know anything else about Robinson's beliefs or his motives?
Yeah, there's been tons of speculations about phrases investigators discovered were engraved in bullet casings believed to be Robinson's. One of them was an anti-fascist slogan, but others appear to be video game and online meme culture references. Online chatter has really focused on whether the etching should be viewed as left-wing messages or far-right messages. There are these groups to the right of Charlie Kirk who often criticized him, and some are linking the phrases to those ideologies, while others see the phrases as leftist slogans. I think right now, Aisha, the bait is just causing a ton of noise. It's really hard to say definitively one way or another, but what seems much more clear is that based on many social media posts, Robinson appears to have been very active in quite fringe and edgy communities on the internet, and he was very into video game culture.
Have we heard at all from Charlie Kirk's family?
Yeah, Erica Kirk, the widow of Charlie Kirk, released a message online Friday about her commitment to continue the mission of Turning Point USA, the activism group and media empire Kirk ran. Here's some of that message.
If you thought that my husband's mission was powerful before, you have no idea. To everyone listening tonight across America, the movement my husband built will not die. It won't. I refuse to let that happen. It will not die.
Yeah, and Turning Point social media channels have added millions of new followers since Kirk's death. Erica Kirk saying the movement will carry on comes after Turning Point announced that Kirk's social media and podcast efforts will continue on.
That's NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Aisha.
While 98% of the U.S. votes on paper ballots, some people vote on machines, then print out a ballot to review before turning them in. President Trump doesn't like that, and his administration is considering banning the machines. Later today on All Things Considered, why this has some election officials worried. Tune in on your radio or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Some relief for borrowers could be just around the corner. The Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates at a key meeting later this week. The decision follows calls by President Trump for the Fed to take far more aggressive action on cutting rates. Joining us now to discuss all this is Justin Wolfers. He's a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, happy to talk economics.
So let's start with the expected rate cut. Why do you think it's happening now?
Yes. It's important to understand that the direction in which you move should depend on where you stand and where you want to get to. So the thing is, right now where we stand is it's as if the Fed has its foot lightly on the brakes of the economy. Mm-hmm. And it thinks that's probably not right. Now might be a good moment to coast into neutral. So it's cutting interest rates, but just a little bit.
And how big of an impact could that have on the economy?
So we economists fight here and there about a quarter of a percentage point versus a half. And these are vicious debates. And we bring all the ammo and data we have to bear. And the truth is, the most important thing is that we get the settings roundabout right. My guess is, whichever side of this one you're on, we're going to end up roundabout in the right place.
And what does that mean? Like, does that mean that people are going to have an easier time buying houses? Will inflation be capped? Like, what would that mean for the regular person?
I love it. You're like, hey, man, you're a teacher. First of all, we're talking about a quarter of a percentage point. Normally, that's so small that it doesn't make a huge difference. Secondly, it does make a difference. And the other thing is, when we're talking about an economy this big, a small fraction of a huge thing can still be a big deal. Mm-hmm. So what it's going to mean is that interest rates on home loans are going to come down. If you have a fixed rate mortgage, it's not going to help you. But if you have an adjustable rate one, it will. We'll see a bigger effect on things like car loans. And life will get a little easier for those who are in debt. Now, on the flip side, if you're someone who's got their money in the bank and you're living off interest, life will get a little bit harder as well. Now, the way all of this adds up is lower interest rates means there's less of an incentive to save for the future. There's more of an incentive for businesses to borrow money and invest in the next big project, and so it may spur the economy. The economy's been slowing a little, so that's a good move. Now, of course, the hotter we run the economy, the more likely we get a little bit of inflation.
Okay, so but the Trump administration has been piling on the pressure for the Fed because President Trump wants big rate cuts. You know, the administration has been trying to get Fed Governor Lisa Cook fired over what it says is mortgage fraud. That's a matter that's currently before the courts. But are you worried that the independence of the Fed is now under threat?
Yes, I'm very worried. So one thing that I think is really important here is, yes, the Fed is cutting rates, but no, Trump is not getting what he wants. What Trump wants is an utterly dramatic rate cut. He said he wants interest rates at 1%, which is the sort of thing you would do if the economy were in free fall. Instead, the Fed's likely to cut rates by a quarter or a half a percentage point. We're going to move from a foot lightly on the brake to being in neutral. Trump wants them to jam the foot on the accelerator right away. He wants to stack the Federal Reserve Board with its people rather than independent economists who would act in the best interests of the American people. This is exactly what President Erdogan did in Turkey. He appointed a loyalist to the central bank. He directed those loyalists to push ahead with low interest rates even as inflation took off. They persisted, and very quickly Turkey got to 86% inflation. You might say that couldn't happen here, but the reason you might say it couldn't happen here is because we have an independent Fed. If that comes under threat, then a lot of very bad outcomes become possible.
President Trump's top economic policy, outside of, you know, talking about lower interest rates, is obviously tariffs. And one of the reasons he says he wants these tariffs is to create jobs at home, especially in the manufacturing sector. What are we seeing on that front?
What we're seeing is we saw manufacturing jobs decline last month. They declined the month before, and they've been declining all through the year. We've lost about 80,000 jobs in 6 months. That's not unusual. American manufacturing has been in decline for decades. That might sound worrying until I remind you that what's been happening is Americans have been climbing up the value chain. We're no longer screwing the lid on toothpaste tubes. We're scientists and engineers designing technologies of the future instead. The tariffs simply have not worked to bring manufacturing back.
Well, what will you be looking out for in the next few months when it comes to the economy?
I'm worried about two bad things happening at the same time. I'm worried about those tariffs hitting and raising prices and boosting inflation. And I'm worried about those tariffs and also the tremendous economic uncertainty that we see right now continuing a step further. Our economy is in a very delicate place. We're one bad move away from a recession. That bad move might already be in the works. We might be lucky and we avoid that bad move, but we're teetering awfully close to the edge. And the crazy thing about all of this, Aisha, is it doesn't have to be this way. This would be the first recession in my lifetime that was caused directly by the policy moves of the White House.
That's Justin Wolfers of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Aisha.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax-deductible. You save time and money while defending KAXE programs you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. The Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids has an open mic night Thursday, September 18th. Doors open at 6, with performances starting at 7.
I'm Duahali Saikautau with these headlines. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has arrived in Israel for a two-day trip where he's expected to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss ending the conflict in Gaza. Earl Richardson, the ninth president of Morgan State University in Baltimore and the visionary behind a successful landmark lawsuit against the state of Maryland for historically underfunding its black colleges, has died at the age of 81. SNL comedian Nate Bargatze hosts tonight's Primetime Emmy Awards. Some of the frontrunners include shows like Severance, The Studio, and Adolescence. I'm Duahali Saikautau, NPR News in New York City.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Nepal is facing its most serious upheaval in years. In less than 48 hours last week, anti-corruption protests toppled the government. Demonstrators torched buildings, looted banks and shops, and attacked politicians in their homes. Now the Himalayan nation has a new leader, Sushila Kirki. She was Nepal's first female chief justice and is now its first female prime minister. NPR's Omkar Khandekar reports from Kathmandu, where Gen Z protesters turned to a different generation to lead their revolution. And a warning to listeners, you will hear gunshots in this piece.
Kathmandu's parliament, a sprawling white building with pagoda roofs, is now blackened with soot and graffiti. One scroll reads, "You picked the wrong fight." It's signed Gen Z. Nepal's capital spent most of the week under curfew. Yet each day, young people still found their way here, snapping selfies and flashing victory signs. 23-year-old Amrendra Shah says he doesn't support such vandalism, but understands the frustration. A trained computer engineer, he still can't find a job. If Nepal was developed, he says, this wouldn't have happened. Such anger surfaced on Monday when thousands of Gen Z youth gathered in front of the parliament to protest against state corruption and Prime Minister Kharga Prasad Oli's sweeping ban on social media. The police crackdown was brutal. Dozens died from gunshot wounds. More than 1,000 were injured. By Tuesday, riots erupted. Government buildings were torched. People clashed with the police. Firearms were stolen. As the chaos spread across the country, tens of thousands of prisoners broke out of jails. One protester, M.B. Lama, says in the days leading up to the demonstration, videos of politicians' children living in luxury went viral on TikTok. He calls them nepo kids.
Doctor kiya, master kiya aadmi log, wo log kya kya rahe?
Lama says that image couldn't be further from the reality most young Nepalis face, where even university graduates often have to leave the country to work as porters or construction laborers. Nepal has seen 16 different governments since its parliament abolished monarchy in 2007. But the top office has mostly rotated between the same set of leaders. The Gen Z protest, says Lama, was a shock to this old guard. The violence calmed down after Prime Minister Oli resigned on Tuesday evening. The army stepped in. Order was restored. Protesters outdoors turned to squabbling indoors. Some Gen Z groups took online polls for an interim chief on the Discord chat portal. 21-year-old student Sonu Mahaset says one name stood out, Sushila Kirki, a former chief justice known for challenging political elites.
She has taken a lot of action against the very political parties, members also, in the court many times.
When Sushila Karki took an oath as Nepal's interim chief on Friday night, supporters in Kathmandu came out on the streets to cheer her. A young man in a black tank top belted out a patriotic song outside the ceremony hall. But not everybody was celebrating. That same evening, Kaili Bohra cremated her son Subhash by the Bagmati River. He had planned to study in Japan. She had worked in India as a house help to fund his future. When police opened fire on protesters at the parliament, Subhash was shot in his chest. Bohra says she doesn't know what will happen in the country next, but she says if the situation doesn't change, his sacrifice would be meaningless. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Kathmandu.
CBS News has covered key moments in our history since the dawn of broadcast news.
We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
2 o'clock Eastern. Edward R. Murrow, Walter Cronkite, and 60 Minutes are all part of its legacy. Now CBS has a new owner, and he's taking significant steps to appease critics on the right, particularly those in the Trump administration. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik has been covering this and joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Aisha.
So first, who is the new owner of CBS, and what's he changed so far?
So there are a couple of quick things David Ellison has done. David Ellison is the founder of Skydance Media, which succeeded in acquiring CBS's parent company this summer. He's also the son of digital titan Larry Ellison. He's the founder of Oracle, and Larry Ellison also a vocal supporter of President Trump. So what Ellison has done, and Paramount Global has done, is it's appointed an ombudsman to field complaints about CBS's coverage and take that to senior executives. The network has agreed to stop running edited interviews on its Sunday public affairs show, Face the Nation, after complaints from the Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem. And Ellison is in serious negotiations to buy Barry Weiss's News and Views site, The Free Press, for over $100 million, maybe more. Weiss has based that site, although that's a high valuation, on the idea that the mainstream media is reflexively and ideologically biased. And he'd be interested in bringing her on board to help run CBS News.
So why might Ellison be doing all of this?
Well, the ombudsman was part of an understanding he had with the chairperson of the FCC who had been appointed by Donald Trump. He says that we're going to ensure that ideological points of view from all parts of the spectrum are represented. Even of itself, that seems pretty reasonable. NPR has a public editor, which is essentially the same thing. But the question is, you know, Kenneth Weinstein, the appointee, is somebody who's got rigorous conservative credentials. He was a Trump appointee, although a nominee who didn't get confirmed by the U.S. Senate to be ambassador to Japan in 2020. And Ellison, you know, seems to be doing this because the Trump administration is angered by CBS coverage again and again. He wanted to give indications that he would be sympathetic to get this deal cleared by the Federal Communications Commission, which it was finally this summer after he met with chairperson Brendan Carr of the FCC. And, you know, there is a sizable portion of the country that agrees with the president. Mainstream media may be in some ways arrayed against him. And Ellison seems to be trying to appease that point of view.
What other changes could be on the horizon for CBS?
Well, it's unclear, you know, if Barry Weiss's Free Press is acquired by Ellison. She, you know, is negotiating right now to become a very senior executive there. Part of the hangup in the deal, I'm told, is that it's a little unclear whether or not she would be put on top of the news division or a strategic executive there. Ana Gomez is the lone Democratic commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission. She's worried that this, what she calls an FCC-imposed truth monitor, must not be allowed to, she said, judge whether independent reporting can conforms to this administration's views and priorities. She continues, that would be a clear violation of the First Amendment and the law. So there's a question there about whether this is, you know, an ombudsman reflecting all points of view, or whether this is somebody who's really there to keep CBS sympathetic to the Trump administration, which is a source of great concern to journalists I talk to inside CBS.
So we're talking about like one media outlet here, but one of the majors. Beyond CBS, why do all these changes matter?
Well, so first off, you know, we've been talking about David Ellison's doing this because he's wanting to get the favor of, you know, major regulators in the Trump administration. He's also preparing a bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. That's the owner of HBO Max. That's the owner of Warner Brothers Studios. And that's the owner, of course, of CNN, one of the biggest players in television news. He wants to consolidate all together with his own properties, which currently include Paramount Studios, CBS News, and the like. And that means that he would be in front of regulators once again, just as he was for his bid to take over CBS's parent company in the first place. Even setting that aside, CBS is such a signal organization. It sets the example for other news outlets that may find themselves pressured by the Trump administration. Are you holding power to account, reporting fairly but toughly upon figures of power? Or are you accommodating them and their interests and their pressure because you want to pursue your business interests of your own? And that's really the challenge in front of CBS and David Ellison right now. Right now, he wants to get all the, you know, toys in the box, and we're going to see what he's going to do them depending on what he has.
That's NPR's David Folkenflik. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Lyrics to a famous anti-fascist Italian anthem appear to be inscribed on one of the unfired bullet casings that authorities are saying was used in the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk last week. NPR's Chloe Veltman explains its evolving history.
Utah Governor Spencer Cox described the lyrics, along with other inscriptions found on discarded bullets, during a news conference on Friday announcing the arrest of Utah resident Tyler Robinson, a 22-year-old suspect in Charlie Kirk's assassination.
A second unfired casing read, "O Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao, Ciao Ciao."
The words, meaning goodbye, beautiful, in Italian, form the chorus of the anthem Bella Ciao.
O Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao.
Performed here by the 20th century Italian diva Milva, the tragic song's lyrics tell the story of a partisan who dies in the pursuit of freedom.
People often think of Bella Ciao as a partisan resistance song.
This is Diana Garvin. She's an assistant professor of Italian at the University of Oregon who's written a study on Bella Ciao.
While that is true, it's only a small slice of the story.
According to Garvin and other sources, the song first became popular in the 19th century among migrant women rice field workers. But Garvin says the lyrics most people know today concerning the dying partisan were not the same as those sung by these workers. Their version, performed here by Giovanna Daffini, focuses on the hardships of life as a laborer.
Oh, mamma mia. Oh, che tormento.
They talk about improved workers' conditions, that one day they will work in freedom and liberty.
When the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini came to power in the 1920s, Bella Ciao became part of labor actions beyond the rice fields. But contrary to popular belief, the song was not widely sung as a resistance anthem during World War II. Garvin says the song re-emerged after the war with the more overtly political lyrics commonly sung to this day.
This time, it's assumed to be a male partisan who is leaving the house saying goodbye to his love, assuming that he will not return, that he'll die in the fight.
The partisan version of the song gained popularity during the 1950s and 60s, spread by radio and TV. Stanislaw Pugliese is a professor of modern European history at Hofstra University, whose work encompasses the anti-fascist resistance.
It's been performed in almost every language from Albanian to Yiddish. So it does seem to strike a chord across borders, across cultures.
And Bella Ciao has taken on a fresh significance in recent years. Politically, it's been co-opted by the left and the right. In January, left-wing activists in Germany sang the song at a protest against the far-right party AfD. A TikTok clip captured the moment. Ciao Bella also shows up on a popular Spotify playlist named for followers of white nationalist pundit Nick Fuentes, a well-known critic of Charlie Kirk. Meanwhile, in the cultural sphere, American vocalist Becky G's version on the Spanish Netflix thriller series Money Heist has helped to popularize the song for a new generation.
Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao.
The official YouTube video has been viewed nearly 60 million times and has elicited more than 11,000 comments since December 2021, including newly posted references to Charlie Kirk's assassination. "This song is about to get real popular," wrote one commentator on Friday, echoing the sentiments of many others. Scholars NPR spoke with for this story, including Stanislaw Pugliese, are expressing concern about the way in which its lyrics have become implicated in the crime.
"There has been a failure to understand the present political moment."
Pugliese's family comes from Calabria. He says the song is most famously sung during Italy's annual national holiday commemorating the country's liberation from fascism. The events of this week have tainted it.
"I'm not sure that we're going to be able to sing that song again in the same way, with the shadow hanging over us."
Pugliese says he hopes Bella Ciao will continue to evolve and resonate in different ways over time. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Frances Daniels, a Baltimore mother of three, read the 20-page report when it came out last Tuesday.
"I was horrified. They never once mentioned substance usage, specifically nicotine."
Nicotine and the chemicals vaped with it, Daniels says, hooked and nearly killed one of her children 3 years ago. Her child spent 6 brutal weeks in the hospital with a lung injury.
"They had about 6 tubes in their lungs at one point, draining fluid out, 3 on each side, with machines on either side of the bed."
The report calls for public service campaigns about the risks of alcohol, controlled substances, and vaping. It also recommends continued crackdowns on illegally imported vapes. That sounds far too weak for Meredith Berkman, co-founder of Parents Against Vaping E-Cigarettes. She says it contrasts with President Trump's stance in 2019 when she met with him.
"He was in the Rose Garden and in the Oval Office talking about youth vaping. The fact that there is not a greater emphasis put on tobacco and nicotine, which is harming youth, it's very, very surprising."
Tobacco use remains the top cause of preventable death in the U.S. That's why Brian King, former head of the Food and Drug Administration's tobacco division, says omissions of smoking, tobacco, and other nicotine products make no sense.
"Attempting to combat chronic disease without tobacco control is like attempting a triathlon without a bicycle. You're destined for failure before leaving the starting line."
King, now executive vice president at the Center for Tobacco-Free Kids, says the administration's stated support for public awareness and greater enforcement run counter to its recent actions.
"In the same breath, the administration has eliminated the very unit that conducts that work at FDA.
The administration also eliminated the Office of Smoking and Health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which funded state tobacco control programs, some of which, he says, are in the process of shutting down. Such programs helped dramatically reduce smoking and, more recently, vaping among teens. With that decline, Penn State public health professor Jonathan Fold says young people today are at far less risk.
"Nicotine itself is not very high on the list of public health priorities for kids."
Nicotine is addictive and affects heart health, but Fold says not all forms of nicotine are the same. Oral nicotine pouches like Zyn, for example, and even vaping may be preferable to cigarette use.
"It's much less harmful than smoking, but it's not harmless. We shouldn't exaggerate the risks of it. We should be glad that they're not smoking."
Fold says so far, there's scant evidence that many people who start vaping in adolescence take up smoking later in life. But in Frances Daniels' experience, it all goes hand in hand.
"Nicotine is harmful, as well as the process of vaping. They're both harmful."
Her child recovered and quit nicotine, she says. But she continues warning others about the risks. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
We'll be right back.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at hibbingchrysler.us. The Bell Museum Statewide Star Party is September 18th through the 20th at 24 locations across Minnesota, including North Star Elementary in Virginia, Thursday, September 18th at 3:30, and at the Blackwater Environmental Area in Cohasset at 7 p.m. United Way of 1,000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org. And now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Dwahli Saikautau with these headlines. Hundreds of South Korean workers who were detained at a U.S. Georgia plant during an immigration raid are now back in their home country. A chartered government plane with the Korean workers arrived in Seoul on Friday. Venezuela's foreign minister accuses the U.S. of provoking a military escalation after personnel from a U.S. warship, quote, illegally and hostily boarded a Venezuelan tuna boat. Residents of a Utah city are in a state of shock and grief that one of their own, 22-year-old Tyler Robinson, is in jail, arrested for aggravated assault, murder charges of Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk. I'm Dwahli Saikautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at RWJF.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. New Zealand is embarking on one of the most ambitious conservation projects in the world, and it's relying on everyday people to help. They're signing up volunteers to help save their unique birds from extinction. Lauren Summer from NPR's Climate Desk has this report.
So, bird's nest.
Mila McKenzie is working in a neighborhood park with her student group in Dunedin, New Zealand. They've done a lot. Cleaned up litter, planted more than 100 trees.
It's lucky almost all of the kids love weeding.
Finn Hibbert is with McKenzie in the group, which is called Townboat Kaitiaki. When I talked to them, Hibbert was 17 and McKenzie was 11. Their volunteer work also involves something most kids don't do.
These are traps, basically, yeah. We call these trapping stations.
They're getting rid of animals that aren't supposed to be in New Zealand.
So we have a possum trap, so the white ones that are up on the trees.
It targets brush-tailed possums, an Australian mammal that was brought here by European settlers. Possums devour native trees. Other traps catch rats, which were also brought here. The traps were specially designed in New Zealand to kill as humanely as possible and to be safe for people to use.
So the new types of traps that we have are really almost child-friendly, so it's really good.
So the whole reason we trap these sort of creatures is they can be damaging to native birds and other native animals they want here.
New Zealand's birds didn't evolve with land mammals. There weren't any, aside from bats. So the birds are extremely vulnerable to invasive predators, especially flightless birds like the kiwi. Rats eat the baby birds, and birds of all sizes are eaten by ferrets and their relatives, stoats. Around 4,000 species overall are considered threatened in New Zealand. So conservation experts say saving those animals means killing others.
Though it is a bit gross sometimes, just thinking about it's a bit gross, it's actually quite an ethical thing because it's easier if you kill off something that's causing a problem then instead of letting them kill off everything else.
Nationwide, New Zealand has a goal of getting rid of these invasive predators by 2050. Much of that work is being done by the government, but people and community groups are volunteering all over.
Oh, there's a tui having a feed on our flax.
James McCarthy spots a black and blue bird in his backyard in Whakatane on a rainy morning.
What we noticed here was that the birds started coming back. We've seen heaps of birds returning and nesting.
That's happened since McCarthy put in native plants and started trapping. He's got four traps right in his backyard. He says it's a commitment to maintain and check them daily, but it's worth it because he can see the difference it makes.
Yeah, I don't feel vengeful about it, but definitely it's our responsibility, especially as a colonized country. All the things that were introduced into it were brought here by colonizers.
Since many of New Zealand's birds are only found here, people have rallied to save them, says Emily Park. She studies the ethics of conservation at the University of Auckland.
There's just a really strong commitment throughout the country to conservation and valuing the natural environment and respecting and caring for the ecosystems around us.
But eliminating invasive predators entirely by 2050 is a huge goal because it'll mean killing off millions of animals. Park says that won't happen without public buy-in.
Predator-free New Zealand is as much a social challenge as it is a biological challenge. This isn't just about coming up with the right technologies and methods. It's about a lot of social change.
Even if invasive species decline, it'll take constant vigilance from the public to keep it that way. Many conservation experts doubt that New Zealand will reach its goal without new tools and technology. But so far, many New Zealanders are stepping in to try to save the animals that make the country unique. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
Illustrator and author Andrea Caceres could not have asked for a more supportive pal than her dog, Toby. The pup has been by her side as she changed careers and moved to a new country. Now he's featured in her new children's book, Hello, Toby. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento recently joined Caceres and Toby for a walk.
It's a cloudy, humid day in New York. McCarran Park is quiet by city standards. There's some cars honking, an ambulance drives by. But Toby, a small brown silky terrier with long whiskers, is completely unfazed.
He is a city dog.
That's his owner, Andrea Caceres.
This is what he likes. He'd rather walk in a park like this than being like upstate. All right, that's Toby. He's a squirrel.
Toby didn't always know his way around New York City. He was born 15 years ago in Valencia, Venezuela. Back then, Caceres was planning to become a civil engineer.
While I was studying, I started illustrating, and I started illustrating Toby.
She graduated with an engineering degree, but she started working as an artist. As Venezuela's socioeconomic crisis deepened, Caceres moved to the U.S. in 2016 and found a position as a textile designer.
When I moved here, I was working designing for other people, and I wasn't doing anything for myself. I didn't have time to do anything for myself.
Worst of all, she had to leave Toby back in Venezuela. So she came up with a project. Every day, for a whole year, she would draw a different dog.
I was like, I'm going to do a dog a day, keeps the stress away, and dog number one, 1st of January 2018, is going to be Toby.
The illustrations took off. Caceres became kind of an influencer for pet portraits. People commissioned her to draw their dogs. She painted murals at coffee shops and vet offices. After more than 2 years, she saved enough to finally bring Toby to New York.
And apparently he has a lot of thoughts about that.
Caceres says her new book, Hello Toby, is a portrait of this period when she first introduced Toby to Harlem. Now they live in Brooklyn.
We just come out. It's a very diverse neighborhood. You see people from everywhere. You meet New Yorkers. You meet people who just moved here. You meet immigrants. And a lot of people speak Spanish, which is Toby's first language. No puede ver otros perros divirtiéndose.
In the book, Toby encounters all kinds of people on his block. Here's Caceres reading.
There are tall families, short families, families that look alike, and families that look different from one another.
It's a simple idea, but she says for her, it's very personal.
I think that's one of the main reasons why I felt at home myself, not just Toby, but I felt at home myself when I moved to the U.S. because I was like, oh, I somehow everybody's different and you're not like anybody else, but you do feel like you belong because of that reason.
She wants young readers to feel that way too.
I wanted to showcase that that was possible and that everybody gets to live together and, you know, enjoy community together, even when they're all different.
In the book, Toby greets all the different families at the park.
But there is one family he loved the best, his own family.
Cáceres says that's also true in real life.
He loves me always. He never doesn't love me. And I just love him back.
And with that, Toby and Andrea Cáceres walk back home.
Venga, Vito.
Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News, New York.
Amanda Pascali is an academic with a new album. Roses and Basil grew from her ethnomusicology research. On it, she mines the history of Southern and Central Europe to create something new.
The sun has shown his face behind the valley.
The song "E voi dormite ancora," it's one of Sicily's first serenatas. And the serenata is essentially a serenade where traditionally a man would go to the balcony or the window of a woman that he wants to marry, sing this song, profess his love, and hope that she wants to marry him, that she is returning those feelings of love. However, the woman does not come out. And the guy, bless his heart, he thinks that she's still sleeping. And my modern version kind of looks back on that and poses the questions, you know, is she really sleeping or is she just leaving him on read?
So wake up, baby. No time for sleeping. It's time you wake up and you say you love me. Till then I'll wait for you until you want me. With tired eyes, my angels say love me. Don't leave me with
Roses and Basil. The title of your album, like it seems like a really lovely, fragrant mix. What do roses and basil mean to you?
It comes from a translation that I did of a very ancient lullaby called La Siminsina. It's translated from Sicilian, which is an ancient language, but it's also a UNESCO classified endangered language. And I started a project a few years ago to translate and kind of share these beautiful songs with people all around the world.
Your new album is described as kind of modern takes on Mediterranean tunes with some Balkan and Latin influences. Why that particular mix?
I started translating the Sicilian songs a few years ago when I won a Fulbright Fellowship to Southern Italy to document these songs. I myself am very mixed from, you know, a mixed Mediterranean and European background. I grew up around a lot of different cultures. I was born in New York City, but I grew up in Houston. All of these influences kind of converged in the music that I make now, which I like to call immigrant American folk music.
My blood's from the desert, underground, 2000 BC. Oh, I come from the streets where Flushing Avenue meets Second Street.
It's not really authentic to any one part of the world, but it's authentic to the liminal space of migration, the space in which many of us feel too foreign for here, too foreign for home, and never enough for both.
I read that you wanted to create a new world through this album. What is this world that you feel like you created?
I am Gen Z. I call on my Gen Z followers, my friends, to be proud of who they are and where they come from. And so the space that I feel I've created is a space where everybody can be who they are without apologies, where we can all exist no matter how weird we seem to other people, how out of place we seem to other people, because music is a tool for that.
You know, you were born in New York City, then moved to Texas. Do you have a particular song like that was inspired by your life in Texas? Like maybe Amore?
Amore, amore, che mai fatto fare? Mai fatto fare? Narrane pazzia. I definitely feel like there's a lot of Texas on Amuri because it begins with a piece of ancient Sicilian prose. Amuri, amuri, chi mai fatto fare una ranni pazzia, and then erupts into this cumbia. Latin music is all around us in Texas. It's so inspiring to me how that spice is celebrated by people around the world.
What is the prose that you're kind of drawing on there?
An ancient Sicilian love poem in which the narrator is saying, my love, what have you made me do? Or what have you done? You've sent me into craziness. And although this poem was written so many years ago, it's ancient, it still feels like something people would say today.
Well, I say it every day, you know.
right. I'm madly in love. What is happening to me? And to the point of, Father, I've forgotten the Hail Mary, which back then was really kind of scandalous. But in the modern day, I've kind of rewritten those lyrics. You know, I've forgotten my own name. I've forgotten who I am.
I'm in too deep. I can't eat, can't sleep. I've forgotten everything that once had made sense to me. I'm born again. Might as well give in to a truth I never knew, that my whole world began with you.
Amore. You know, it sounds like a lot of what you're getting at with this album is kind of the connectivity between cultures and how, you know, we kind of tell these different stories. There may be cultural differences, but, you know, the kind of searching for love and family and all of that remains the same, right? Like, there's these things, these universal, like, human themes.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And I think that it goes back to the very essence of what makes us human, which are, you know, feelings, emotions, and of course, art.
My angel, sweet dreams, soon your papa will come, it seems, and he'll bring you the roses and basil, the roots and the hazel, saffron and thyme. And
there are also songs about my childhood, about my sisters, about being the oldest daughter in an immigrant family, and of course about my parents, about their story. My parents sacrificed a lot for me to have the life that I do. And now I'm singing and playing music on a stage because of what they did for me.
That's Amanda Pascali. Her new album is Roses and Basil. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Aisha.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in 3 new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Thank you.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Find the latest Up North report at KAXE.org. News from our region, heard on the morning show, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. Is there news in your region we should know about? Email news at KAXE.org. Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade hosts Starapalooza Saturday, September 20th at 5 p.m. with indoor